Der ZZF-Podcast. Aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
Welcome to the podcast of the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam, Germany. My name is Lee Holtz, and I will be hosting this English language version of the ZZF podcast. We're going to focus on bringing the research from Germany's foremost institute in contemporary history to an international audience. I'll be speaking with historians from the institute about a wide range of topics, from the history of energy to illiberal constitutionalisms. And today, I'm speaking with Bodie Ashton on the subject of diversity. Bodie is a research fellow at the center, and their most recent book is entitled The Pet Shop Boys and the Political: Queerness, Culture, Identity, and Society. They are also co-editor with Sarah Franking and Ned Richardson Little of the forthcoming work Deviant Global Germany: Transnational Histories of Crime, Morality, and Mobility. They are also the co-editor with Jonah Gard of the series Transnational Queer Histories from De Gruyter Bill. Welcome, Bodie.
Thanks, Lee. It's great to be here.
I'd like to ask first, how did you come to be interested in diversity as a scholarly topic?
Well, the first thing that I should do here actually is also part of my answer. Just to start off for listeners, I'm an Australian. You might be able to tell that I'm not a German by my accent and my name. That means that I was raised on and I was educated on Kaurna land in what's now known as Adelaide in South Australia. And so at this point, I do want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land, past, present and future, and recognize that their sovereignty was never ceded. And this is actually a really important thing for me to be able to say as an Australian, because this is very important to not only my praxis as a historian, but also who I am as a person. And I think this is actually part of this answer here. So I am an Australian, but it took me leaving Australia to realize how little I knew about the place that I came from, beyond the very basic sort of quite normative baseline that we all tend to receive, which tends to be very, very white, very Christian, very Anglophone and Anglocentric. In Australia, I never actually studied Australian history at any point in time. So it really did take me coming to Germany over 10 years ago now to recognize that, you know, I didn't actually know that much about the rest of my own country. I mean, it's home to the Australian Aboriginals and the Torres Strait Islanders, who are the oldest continuing society in the world. They've been there for at least 60 millennia. That's quite some history. But so much of this has over the years been so easily and airily dismissed or diminished because of the fact that a lot of the history of these people is kept in oral tradition, which has typically been seen through public historical engagement as being quote unquote backwards outside of that normative hegemony. But there's just so much there to be known. And this was sort of a shameful moment for me to realize that actually I didn't know that much. So, you know, that's sort of this basic background of where I come from. But in terms of what I do as a historian, I actually started out being a straight down the line 19th century political, diplomatic and social historian. My dissertation was on the Kingdom of Württemberg during the time of the German unification. And part of that work, as an interesting aside, I was looking at the King of Württemberg, a guy called Karl, who was very, very gay. And what was fascinating to me was the fact that this was an open secret, or sometimes not even a secret. The press actually openly wrote about when he appeared in public with his lover, an American man named Charles Woodcock. And the press didn't like this, but not for the reasons that I had expected, which were, I assume them to be deeply homophobic, but instead their problem was, well, the king's lover is very ugly and we think he can do better. This was so unexpected, of course, that I kind of thought, well, there's something more here. There's something to look at here that I didn't expect. And so these are my villain origin stories, really.
Once you moved into your career in contemporary history, how did your understanding of diversity develop as you continued your research?
Well, certainly when I started moving towards the 20th century, you know, I've done that shift of I started with the 19th, I went back into the 18th a little bit. Now I mostly do 20th century, so you know, we're doing hundreds and hundreds of years here. But this also largely developed because I generated an interest in queer history, and so I started, you know, looking at the through lines that we have here and looking at the gaps in our knowledge and understanding that we have now, and the also the received understanding of not only periods in history that passed. There's this idea that always seems to come about that we have this linear progression in history, that it was bad before and now we're more liberal, and we're just going to become more liberal in the future. And obviously this is false. But it's also a very seductive narrative, and it's something that I certainly felt needed to be challenged, but part of that also requires, you know, going into the weeds and sort of looking at complicating this existing narrative quite a bit more. And so that ended up becoming very central to my work.
Where has your work on diversity taken you in terms of your scholarship? Like, what are you working on right now?
So I've got a couple of projects on the go at the moment, actually. The first is a book project that I've just started, which is effectively looking at the erosion, or rather the ways in which transgender people lived in Germany throughout the 20s through to the 40s, and how this gradually was eroded, but also an emphasis on that living. No, how people actually lived in the past, how they experienced themselves. That's sort of at the heart of this. And I think this is also especially important given what we're seeing at the moment with sort of this backlash to transgender rights, especially in countries that we imagine to be the liberal democratic bastions, where we've had these hard-won queer rights, places like the United States, the United Kingdom, but also Germany. That's a work that is also a response to this, to sort of be like, well, we can go back and we can have a look at how people engaged in the past, especially also as the past moved towards these more illiberal times and more repressive times and escalated in such a way. But the other project that I have on the go at the moment is looking after the war and looking at the recovery of trans communities in West Germany in particular, basically proceeding on this idea of you do have these vibrant, gender diverse, queer communities, people we would call trans now or would fall under an umbrella of trans, before the Nazis came to power. And after the Nazis are defeated, these communities have effectively been smashed. But they don't disappear. There are still trans people. And obviously, you know, they gain more and more prominence such that by the start of the 1980s, the West German government is legislating about trans people with the first Transsexuellengesetz. So obviously they become more and more important in this period such that they become a political issue. And my question here is basically how? How do these communities that were smashed by 1945 recover enough that they then become this important political issue as of the 1980s and certainly beyond? And I want to emphasize here that there are transnational connections between similar communities in other places close to West Germany. So that you have networks of support, both material and otherwise, coming from places outside of West Germany, coming in.
So people find each other after the war in these communities. I mean, the entire continent was in disarray and there were refugees underway in every possible direction. How did they find one another after the war?
I mean, this is going to be one of the important questions of the project, right? Like, how do you reform a community that is gone, effectively, that has been exploded? And certainly, one of the issues that we have here is that we know that there are plenty of trans people who do actually survive the war. So we have a number who were persecuted, a number who were killed, but we also have some who survived the war, and we know of them. But they survived largely because they kept their heads down. And as a result, they don't necessarily take a position of prominence after the war. So until recently, we thought that Dora Richter, the first trans woman to have what we would call gender-affirming surgery at Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute for Sexual Science in Berlin, we thought she died during the war. But only recently has it been uncovered by my colleague Clara Hartmann that in fact she survived. And she lived for decades afterwards, but in obscurity, in a small rural village, where she didn't make waves, and she wasn't this sort of lightning rod of community. So you see that there are plenty of trans people in West Germany after the war, who have sort of learnt the lesson to keep their heads down and not to draw any attention. But at the same time, you have an increasingly public number of visible trans people outside of West Germany who are then acting as a forebild, so to speak, for people who remain within Germany. So it's not really a coincidence that during the 1950s and 1960s, you get the rise of a number of variety shows that include a number of gender diverse people who are generally exoticized. And it's emphasized that they come from somewhere else. And this, I think, is probably the genesis of the rebuilding of these sorts of communities, that you then have people who are able to be standard bearers who aren't necessarily initially from Germany themselves. And German trans people are sort of taking a little bit of a back seat as opposed to what it had been under the Weimar years.
Could you just talk a bit more about this transnational component of the development of diversity? It's very striking to me that before the war, national cultures were largely insular, homogenous. And then after the war, the socio-political realities, the fracturing of those nation states, is then also accompanied by a new diversity in all kinds of dimensions of human life.
I mean, there's an interesting tension that's there. And I think one of the points here to really make clear is that, yes, there is a sort of national insularity before the war, but there also isn't. These sorts of identities that we're talking about here, so for me that's queer identities or people who would be regarded as trans now, these don't know national boundaries. You know, you're not trans because you're German. You're not queer because you're from Berlin. And in fact, we see well before the war and in the Weimar period, for instance, that Germany becomes, and particularly Berlin, but also Hamburg and other places, become sort of gathering points for a number of queer people from around the world. You get a lot of, British queer people end up in Berlin. Very famously, Christopher Isherwood, W.H. Auden come to Berlin. We could almost call them sex tourists, really, because they're actually coming to experience being gay. Part of that is sex. But they've come to Berlin to experience their homosexuality because that is something that they're able to do in Berlin that they're not as easily able to do elsewhere. There's also the sexual sciences, sexology, and so on. A huge number of the sexologists who end up in the Scandinavian countries are trained initially in Berlin. Also, you have other sexologists. Harry Benjamin becomes a very important one in the United States. He's very famous for arguably popularizing the term transsexual, and also being responsible for the care of Christine Jorgensen, the famous former GI trans woman from the United States. But he too was trained under Hirschfeld in Berlin. So you have these very interesting connections in which the world is kind of coming to Germany. And then going back and the expansion of these queer identities is part and parcel of the pre-war years as well. So it is important to me that these connections already exist, that these are also identities that to some extent know no borders. A gay man in London and a gay man in Berlin might not share nationality, but they share sexuality. And these are identities that can cross these constraints of geopolitical borders. It's only since you have this calamity at the end of the war that you have these destroyed communities and so on, but also the opportunity to rebuild, that you end up having people being able to come back or actually start building something. And at the same time, you still see a lot of the influence of the pre-war years happening. So there's still this, there's a discourse that still exists in Denmark, for instance, of the fact that Denmark was well ahead of a lot of the world in terms of its queer rights. It creates an explicit queer rights organization in 1948. And at least one of the narratives of why this happened in Denmark before elsewhere was the fact that Denmark's quite close to Berlin. So you have these connections already hard baked into these communities.
Still speaking about the post-war era and the reconstitution of queer or transgender communities, were there differences in developments in the East and the West?
Oh, absolutely. Not my place necessarily to talk about so much. My focus here is a lot more on West Germany, because my standpoint here is effectively that we know so little about trans history post-war. It would be fantastic to have comparative studies of East and West Germany, but in order to do that, we really need to know where we stand for at least one of them, so that we have points of comparison in the first place. And this sort of history simply doesn't exist so far for either. Queerness in general, there have been some landmark works that have been done. Andrea Rottmann, for instance, has recently published Queer Lives Across the Wall, which looks at queer relationships in sort of this flashpoint of East and West Berlin. Sam Klaus Hunecker has written a fantastic book called States of Liberation, which looks specifically at gay movements in both East and West Germany and compares them. The point here is that we do have some very interesting and very complex competing narratives, where there is also this kind of received image that East Germany was actually further ahead on gay or queer rights compared to the West, that as a result of not being hard-boiled conservative, as a result of being a little bit less concerned about the sort of moral imperatives that were at play here. The truth is significantly more complicated than that, as Sam Hunecker points out, among others. But this just demonstrates how much more is needed right now, how much more research is required.
You and I also recently spoke about how the history of transgender communities in Germany continues to be contested, specifically about the persecution that went on under the Nazis. And you were recently involved in a court case, I believe. I think we'd like to hear more about that.
I'll keep that a little bit general. Effectively, there was a court case that was heard in Cologne in 2022-2023, in which I don't really need to go into the specifics so much there, but it was simply the fact that someone had been accused of denying National Socialist crimes by suggesting that trans people had not been persecuted under the Nazis, and had therefore brought a case of defamation. And I was asked to write a legal brief to answer the question of whether trans people actually were persecuted, and also, I mean, the first question of that is, were there trans people at the time of the National Socialists? I was not the only person asked to do that. My colleague Laurie Marhofer from the University of Washington also wrote a brief for that. And the end result of that was effectively to say, yes, trans people existed, or people we would understand as trans now. They didn't use the same terminology, of course. Our vocabulary has developed quite a lot in the in the intervening decades. So we don't have people who call themselves trans or transgender at this time, but certainly the characteristics as we understand them would place them under the umbrella of trans now. So yes, trans people existed. Yes, they were certainly persecuted by the Nazis as well. And the decision from the court and then on appeal by the upper court, was effectively, though they weren't explicitly judging on the question of whether or not trans people were persecuted, it was part and parcel of the decision. So de facto, there is a legal precedent now to establish that, yes, trans people were persecuted under the Nazis. This has also been acknowledged by the Bundestag, the German parliament, which included queer people of all stripes in its Holocaust memorialization on the 27th of January in 2023. And more recently, there has been a discussion in the Bundestag, then the Bundesrat, so the German equivalent of the Senate, effectively as to whether trans and queer people should be protected under the Constitution, under Article 3, its anti-discrimination clause. And a lot of that has been on the basis of, were these people discriminated against or persecuted under the Nazis as well? And that was something that was an open hearing in 2023 that I was also involved in, along with colleagues of mine, including Anna Heikova from the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom, and the fact that most of us there as experts were actually historians points to the importance of the history here to the present day constitutional discussions.
Another question now that brings us more closely into the present. Why has diversity become such a front and center issue throughout the world?
I mean, there are a few answers to this. And I think that one of the basic ones here is that we have become, well, it's not necessarily that we have become more diverse societies, but we've become more openly diverse societies. And there's also the point here that, and we're also talking here in the context of higher education and academia, of course, higher education has become much more of a mass education apparatus. It's no longer necessarily the purview of a very small elite. Here in Germany, for example, higher education is free. That does mean that students from, theoretically at least, students from a wide range of backgrounds can now access university education where previously they couldn't. In other countries, you have similar things as well. The advent of education loans in a number of places, whatever we want to think about education loans, has still made it possible to go to university and to study there. So that means there aren't just elites anymore. That means that this is not entirely restricted to vast majority men from a particular social class, from a particular socioeconomic background, from a particular racial or ethnic background. You have women, you have queer people, you have people of color, you have a whole heap of people who are finally able to access higher education. And of course, they're coming into this. And if we're looking at history, for example, the traditional histories that we have also tend to be pale, male, and stale. And so there is this want of people coming to universities of being like, well, where am I in this history? Because clearly I exist and I didn't spring up from nowhere. I have forebears. Where are they in this history? So there is certainly a lot of looking for ourselves in history, and that has made this shift possible, and it's lit a fire under us a little bit to sort of take on more diverse topics in what we do. Also, I think that there is a degree of a dissatisfaction with a certain inertia that we have in a lot of the world now. The idea of, well, that's how it's always been done, no longer really works for us. You know, there's a lot of disenfranchisement. There's a lot of unhappiness with the way things are run, are taught, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that we know this and we recognize that we don't have the post-scarcity society that we thought we might have. We don't have the great benevolent, wonderful wonderland of unfettered rights and so on. And so maybe we need to actually start questioning the basis behind all of these assumptions. And that means being open to alternate approaches, being open to different ideas, and being open to a more diverse cast of characters in our history and in our present, and people who have agency, who don't just have things done to them.
So diversity can sometimes be a perhaps uncomfortable topic in conservative cultural circles. And how do you think scholars can communicate innovative, cutting-edge research on the subject of diversity to a broader public? And perhaps a follow-up question to that would be, do you think that scholars and academics have a responsibility towards the public, some sort of educational imperative, or is that presumptuous?
I'm going to answer these in reverse order. Do we have a responsibility towards the public? Yes, 100%. There is no question in my mind of that. Is that presumptuous? I don't think so. It's one of the things that a number of people seem to believe, that everyone can just do history. And I certainly believe that history belongs to everyone. The democratization of history has been a wonderful thing that has happened. And there is a magnificent appetite of the general public. People like history. They often don't like the way they used to be taught it. They often have very bad memories of what it was like in school, for example, where it was all timelines and you know, remember the name of this king. But in reality, I very rarely come across people who are not interested in history and in some ways deeply fascinated by various elements of it. So, you know, there is this appetite for it there, and we have the privilege and the honor to have been trained in how to be the custodians of this history. We're not the gatekeepers, but we're the custodians. We're the people who have been given the critical training to interpret, to understand, and to be able to communicate this. And quite frankly, if we don't do that beyond the, you know, the cliched ivory towers of academia, then I don't actually understand what we're doing or why we're there. We do have that responsibility. We do have that obligation. And again, we do have that privilege to be able to do that. So absolutely, that is a responsibility that we have. Is this uncomfortable in some conservative circles? Yeah. Some of this discomfort is perhaps a little bit understandable. I like to lie to myself a little bit and say that I'm relatively young-ish still. There are plenty of people who I work with who have been doing history for literally decades before me. There are plenty of people who have been trained in a certain method of history. There are certainly people who continue to do, again, I was sort of dismissive of my previous work when I was like, well, it's straight down the line political diplomatic history, you know. There are people who do extremely good political and diplomatic history. And quite a lot of those may not take into account certain more diverse topics. It's possible to hear something like this, where I've been talking about, this is our responsibility, this is our obligation, here, let me talk about trans history for a bit, and then to think, well, you know, I did political history of the 1970s, and trans people didn't turn up in that. Are you saying that my history is bad? Or that, you know, I'm not a good historian, or something along those lines? There's definitely a way to feel defensive about that. And to that, I would certainly answer that we, you know, no one can do everything. We need to approach history in a way that is open and in good faith. I don't advocate that every single person listening to this, or every single person wherever I work, or every single person in the discipline around the world needs to suddenly put down tools and start writing trans history. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. what I do argue is that we need to be open to the possibility that there are potentially these further aspects that could integrate into our work. That, you know, there are labor history implications of trans history in West Germany, as I've discovered more recently. There's some incredible media history that is to be done about this. There's a lot to be said, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to focus on it. But I think an open mind, which is certainly something that we're encouraged to have as a major part of our training, an open mind is extremely important to all of this. And that would be sort of my answer to the fears of, let's say, some more conservative elements of the discipline.
And moving outside the discipline, outside of the field of history or even the field of humanities, I wanted to ask you, how does the study or discussion of contemporary history, and we can remain focused here somewhat on the dimension of diversity, how does that affect sociopolitical reality or what we call the real world?
Oh, this is the relevance question. I hate the relevance question, but I also love it. It's important. I very much have the love-hate relationship here. So I'm going to give my boilerplate answer to be that we don't need to boil everything down to relevance, that research for research's sake is actually valid and should be done. However, there is a real-world relevance to all of this. So we've already touched on the aforementioned court case, the fact that, you know, there is a de facto acknowledgement in German law now that trans people were persecuted has important implications for the understanding of the trans past and therefore also the trans present. We can also point, for example, to the work that's been done by a number of my colleagues in post-colonial or decolonial studies, which has led, for example, to things as basic but also as important as the renaming of roads and public spaces in Germany, away from names that were deeply racist or based in a colonial past, and to recognize that actually, you know, there have been important people from what we might call quote unquote diverse backgrounds in this country that has previously been sort of understood in this existing narrative as being quite homogenous. Nothing could be further from the truth, but this has not necessarily been reflected in our public spaces. And this is slowly changing, not without protest, but it's slowly changing. And I think this can only be an important and good step because it provides visibility and it provides representation. And an important aspect of how communities see themselves or are seen as being legitimate, for better or worse, is having a community history. And so to have that community history front and center is very important to recognize people as they are now. On the flip side, what we're seeing right now in, for example, the United States, where we're seeing the erasure of the specific histories of women or people of color from government history initiatives, or taking down monuments that acknowledge the past of chattel slavery, or removing mention of transgender people from the Stonewall National Monument. This actually shows the flip side here. This is demonstrating, again, the importance of history to the social existence of various communities. And consequently, it is not a coincidence that one of the first steps in what we might look at as repressive measures is the erasure of that history. So we have sort of this rather negative acknowledgement that this history does have, and this history of diversity has an extremely important socio-political consequence, and so therefore does the elision of it.
Thank you very much, Bodhi, for speaking with us today, and I'm looking forward to reading your future work.
It's been a pleasure. It's lovely to be able to talk about these things, and I do hope that people listening might also be encouraged to go out and seek their own histories, and to be able to see themselves in history, and not necessarily to believe that they have to conform to a particular narrative. This is the great thing about our history. It is more diverse than you can possibly imagine, and we are building on that understanding day by day.
Der ZZF Podcast. Aus dem Leibniz-Zentrum für zeithistorische Forschung in Potsdam.
In this episode, we talked about diversity, and next time, we'll be talking to Ned Richardson Little about his recent book, The German Democratic Republic, The Rise and Fall of a Cold War State. This is the ZZF podcast from the Leibniz Center for Contemporary History in Potsdam. It would be great if you joined us next time. Click on subscribe to automatically receive notice when we publish our next episode. Goodbye, and see you next time.